Welcome to Proclaiming Christ, where we seek to encourage and stimulate preachers, teachers, and students of the Bible in their desire to see Christ preached and taught in all of Scripture. This is episode number 127. My name is Mark Winder, pastor of Wolf River Presbyterian Church in Collierville, Tennessee. Today, we open up our Bibles to Genesis chapter 33. We look at being reconciled with God and man. Joining with me today, Robert Arendale from Redeemer OPC in Dayton, Ohio. Welcome, Robert.
Hey, Mark. Great to be with you as always.
I look forward to opening up this text from Genesis 33. We are a podcast of the Reformed Forum, and you'll find more about us, of course, at reformedforum.org. And you can go online to Reform Forum and look at the various things that we have there, from the podcasts that we offer, Christ the Center, Theology Simply Profound, to our academy with the ever-growing catalog of courses that you can take, and many of them fit for anything from, some of them, quite frankly, doctoral level studies, as well as Sunday school lessons. You also find a link there for adult Sunday school courses, and those are video courses that are specifically designed for adult Sunday school. So if you're looking for a Sunday school class to do, or maybe you're very busy, or you need time, something to fill in for a time for some of your Sunday school classes, you'll find some great material there, a number of course offerings there as well, all on video. That you're able to present to your Sunday school. Well, today we look at Genesis chapter 33. It's a short chapter, just 20 verses or so. And we're going to look at what happens in the chapter and then see some principles of interpretation. One principle of interpretation that we'll look at is how in smaller narrative passages, we should seek to make connections with the larger narrative that's going on. Genesis is a big story, and the vignette that we look at in Genesis 33 is really connected to that larger story of the book. Genesis is a book of patterns, and it's patterns as part of the one overarching story of redemption. You might recall, and you can hear this on previous episodes where we've gone through Genesis chapter 32 in a couple of episodes as well. What's going on here? We see if this was a play that's taking place between Esau and Jacob. It takes place in a number of acts. Act 1 would be the beginning of chapter 32. Esau is coming, and Jacob is afraid. Act 2 is Jacob preparing for the worst. He's dividing his group into a couple of camps, and he sends the lavish gift on to Esau. We saw that as well, and how he prepares for that. And then we saw last time the intermission in the conflict between Jacob and Esau, and that is Jacob wrestling with the man at the river Jabbok. Looked at the significance of that wrestling and who he's wrestling with and the covenant implications of that. But today we come to the resolution of the conflict between Jacob and Esau as they come together and then they go their own way. Let me just go ahead and start out by reading the chapter, and it really is the big picture that we kind of need to see. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two female servants. And he put the servants with their children in front, then Leah with their children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. He went himself before them, bowing himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And when Esau lifted up his eyes and saw the women and children, he said, "Who are these with you?" Jacob said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." Then the servants drew near, they and their children, and bowed down. Leah likewise, and her children drew near and bowed down. And last, Joseph and Rachel drew near, and they bowed down. Esau said, "What do you mean by all this company?" Jacob answered, "To find favor in the sight of my lord." But Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." Jacob said, "No, please. If I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand. For I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. Please accept my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." Thus he urged him, and he took it. Then Esau said, "Let us journey on our way, and I will go ahead of you." But Jacob said to him, "My lord knows that the children are frail, and that the nursing flocks and herds are a care to me. If they're driven hard for one day, all the flocks will die. Let my lord pass on ahead of his servant, and I will lead on slowly at the pace of the livestock that are ahead of me, at the pace of the children, until I come to my lord in Seir." So Esau said, "Let me leave you with some of the people who are with me." But he said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. But Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the place is called Succoth. And Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, on his way to Paddan Aram, and he camped before the city. And from the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, he bought for 100 pieces of money the piece of land on which he had pitched his tent. There he erected an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. So that's our text this morning, and depending on when you're listening to it, it could be our text this afternoon. But if this is the last act of a play, then this act would have four scenes to it. And the first one is Jacob's apprehension as he approaches Esau. The suspense of meeting Esau now comes to a head, as over the horizon, Esau comes with 400 men. So everything in the previous chapter is building up to this moment when Esau's army of 400 comes marching toward him. Verse 1 mentions that 400 again, and that heightens the tension. It's supposed to make you think about the imminent threat. Is this the end of Jacob? And as you're preaching or teaching this, and this is something that I think we've discussed before, you need to keep that tension in the sermon. Of course, you know, we know our Bibles and we know what happens in most of these stories, but as you're reading this, there's a sense in which it's kind of like reading a suspense novel. You're not supposed to know what happens. And that's why the text begins by saying, Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there's like a big sign to you, that word behold, saying you're supposed to look too. Jacob looked, and now you look. Esau's coming. And keep that tension in the sermon. But Jacob doesn't display any fear. It kind of reminds us of what David said in Psalm 56 when he was captured by the Philistine, when he says, when I am afraid, I'll put my trust in you, in God whose word I praise, in God I trust, I shall not be afraid. It repeats that several times there in Psalm 56. And Jacob displays this kind of faith. He displays no fear. He prepares for Esau's arrival. He arranges his family to greet Esau. And again, if you're teaching, preaching this passage, you may want to elaborate on that a little bit and go back to the text and talk about how he arranges the family. It's the opposite of the way that you would expect. You'd think that he'd put his pride and joy right up front in Rachel and her children, but he does the opposite. He puts his servants up front, then Rachel's of last. So if it does turn out that Esau wants his head, then, you know, the back half of his entourage maybe would have an opportunity to escape his favorites in the back. So there's a very strategic arrangement that he makes here. But he gets in front of his family and he starts to approach Esau. And notice how he does it. He bows himself to the ground 7 times until he comes close to Esau. And we've talked a little bit before about Jacob's humility. He calls himself Esau's servant. He sends the gifts, an indication that he acknowledges his wrongdoing. Bowing, of course, was very prominent in the ancient Near East, still prominent today, particularly in the Orient. But to bow 7 times, and the verb that's used indicates he really bows. He's not doing, you know, when King Charles was his coronation, you know, when he went up the center aisle, if anybody watched a portion of that, you know, people kind of nod their head, you know, kind of thing. This isn't nodding your head. I mean, he prostrates himself. He stretches his body out on the ground 7 times, the way that a subject would present himself to a king. One ancient document talks about a subject of Pharaoh who approaches his court, bowing 7 times in a like manner. And that would be the significance of what's happening here, the honor that he's giving to Esau. But it's also then worth noting that the last time he saw Esau, this is where you want to make that connection to the larger narrative, of course, was when he had stolen his blessing, and you want to connect it to that larger story. Part of the contents of Isaac's blessing on Jacob, the blessings that Isaac had intended for Esau, part of the contents of that was that his mother's children would bow down to Jacob. In other words, Esau would bow down to Jacob. So the point of that is that Jacob's on the top rung of the ladder and Esau would be subservient to him. So there's significance in Jacob's humility. There's a sense in which he is acknowledging wrongdoing and humbling himself before his brother. We also, I think, can find some practical application here, by the way, too. And there's plenty of points of practical application throughout this narrative. But one of them, how do you resolve conflict? You do so by approaching in humility. And it works. And we see that in the next act, if you will.
Just a brief thought, and simply to echo what you said in terms of the drama that we're supposed to feel in the story. And you highlighted that as preachers and as those who know how the story ends, we can often miss that. At the time of recording, I'm preaching through the life of David on Sunday mornings. And similarly, chapter in David's life, David's on the run, he's in the wilderness, and seemingly every single chapter, there's this great, dramatic moment. Is David going to make it? And we know that he does make it. But just to echo what you said, that I think as preachers, we need to really think about, at least spend a little bit of time thinking about ways to underscore the drama of the moment and the drama as these, redemptive history is unfolding, to try to put our congregants there in the story, so to speak. Just imagine if you don't know how the story ends, and, be creative in a sense. Try to paint the picture of what's going on instead of just flying right on by and not really pausing. But, especially in these great narrative stories, we need to, slow down, I think, sometimes and give some thought to how to make the scene come alive when we really know it's all going to end. Jesus is going to come. But I just want to echo that point that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, great point, Robert. It's worth noting, and I think as preachers, teachers, we should be good storytellers because these narrative sections are stories, and we should, this is God's inspired, inerrant word, but we don't want to read it, in a bland sense, that there needs to be the tension, the story there. It's also worth noting that while we have the Word of God in print and multiple versions and multiple copies, God's people, as they're reading stories like this in the wilderness, they typically don't have it in print. They heard it read to them. So it was a story to them, a story of God's great redemptive work, but they're used to listening to them. So, good to emphasize that, Robert. Well, as we move along in the story, then, we're kind of getting ready for the kill as the army marches against Jacob. I mean, this is it. There is an army coming against him, but instead, you talk about an about face. We see five verbs in rapid succession that indicate a radical change of mood right in the middle of this scene. So this is where the music swells, and this is it, the moment of great tension. And then suddenly, verse 4, these five verbs, Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. This is the stuff that tearjerker scenes are made of. We're expecting heads to roll, but the brothers embrace and they weep, and there's this overwhelming sense of relief. And all the more so when we consider the fact that the way Moses writes this puts Esau's actions now in direct contrast, again, connecting it with the larger story, with his actions when he despised his birthright for a bowl of lentil stew. Back in chapter 25, and you can find that in a previous episode, we saw there were five verbs in rapid succession that told the story of how Esau kind of, just crassly throws away his birthright. He ate, drank, rose, went, despised. Now he runs, embraces, falls, kisses, weeps. So this is a beautiful picture that marks the end of their conflict as brothers. So there you have the beginning of the conflict. Here you have the end of the conflict marked off by these verbs set in juxtaposition to one another, communicating something quite different now, resolution of that conflict. And it's a testament to the grace of God that God transforms the most difficult, strenuous relationship that really you can imagine is Jacob and Esau. And he turns it for his, and it's such a profound reversal. Some people have a hard time accepting that this actually happened. They believe that this is a polish that is added later to the text. John Currid, a good Old Testament scholar who's written a number of good commentaries on the Pentateuch, said that one Jewish commentary changes the words from, and he kissed him, to, and he bit him. So It can't possibly be that good of a story. But no, this is a supernatural thing that's taking place. And this is none other than God himself at work. So as Esau welcomes Jacob, he looks beyond him. He sees his family. Jacob gives credit to God for his family. In verse 5, there's a different Jacob than the one who left. And probably there is a bit of implied hope that Esau would recognize God's favor to him. And, you know, you need to show favor to me because God's favored me. They come forward to Esau then, just the way that Jacob had arranged them, and they bow down. It doesn't say they bow down 7 times, but the theme of bowing is still very prominent in verses 6 and 7. Again, this humility. So Esau asks, you know, what do you mean by all this company that I met in verse 8? And he's referring to the waves of gifts that Jacob had sent to him. We saw that a couple episodes ago. And It speaks, the word that he uses here, the company, is a word that speaks of an army. Esau's coming with 400 men, but Jacob had come with an army of presents to give Esau. And Esau's overwhelmed at the army of gifts. So why did you send them? And Jacob answers, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. That's an honest answer. Jacob the deceiver is gone. He's open and honest about why he sent these things. You know, that Esau would look on him graciously, refers to him as my Lord. But look how Esau responds in verse 9. He refers to Jacob as brother. And then, and this was customary in the ancient Near East, he refuses the gift initially. So it's a polite refusal, sort of the way that, you know, if somebody offers to spring for lunch, you resist a little bit. And, you know, and you politely say, no, I got it. But then he grabs the check and you object a little until it's appropriate to accept. And it just makes us feel comfortable. And that's, we're not that much different, really, from the protocol in the ancient Near East. Esau says, no, I'm fine. I have enough. Keep what you have for yourself. It's a polite refusal, but the way Jacob says this, it contains a hint that this is remuneration for the blessing that he stole. He's paying Esau back. And it appears that Esau may be saying to him, keep the gift, keep the birthright, keep the blessing. Now, keep that in mind for just a minute. Jacob responds, not with a polite insisting, but a, I won't take no for an answer. Jacob just removes the subtlety in the polite dance that's going on. And he's letting Esau know, you know, to me, Esau, this is an official transaction. By receiving this gift that I bring you, I'm not just being nice. By receiving this gift, you're declaring that you hold nothing against me, that we're even. So Jacob, verse 10, no, please, if I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand, for I've seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. There's the deal. Please accept my blessing that is brought to you, because God's dealt gracious with me, and because I have enough. So something just a little subtle happens here. Jacob changes the word to describe his gifts to Esau from the word gift, and he's used that word now 5 times, to the word blessing. Blessing is what he stole from Isaac. Okay, so again, connecting this with that larger narrative, he's making clear to Esau that he really considers this gift to be the blessing, to be compensation for the blessing. So for the first time, he tells Esau, accept my blessing. So there's kind of a lesson here in conflict resolution. Neither one of them actually mentions the incident of Jacob stealing the blessing. We saw that back in chapter 27. But they both understand that in receiving this compensation, Esau's basically telling Jacob, fine, the blessing is yours, fair and square. You've paid for it. I give it to you. And all's fine between us. And Jacob really takes this seriously. And you can see that by what he says in verse 10, last part. I've seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. Now, what had Jacob just done? He had just wrestled with God. And just as he had seen God, and God had spared him from destruction, even though he deserved it, so Esau, I've seen you, and you spare me from destruction. This is a totally different Jacob. This is a truly repentant man. He wants to pay the price. In a sense, you could say he wants to make atonement. He knows that he's wronged Esau. Bowed down before God, and I begged for mercy, and he spared me by his grace. So I pray that I found favor in your sight, beg you for mercy, and spare me. So Esau does. And there's a sense in which this is the final trading away of the birthright and blessing. Esau offers no gift in exchange, and that would be customary by the way, if this was a gift being given by Jacob, then Esau would offer a gift in return. But there is no gift in return, because this isn't just a gift, it's a transaction. And Esau understands that this is a transaction. This is compensation for the blessing. And there are, by the way, over 400 witnesses to this. So this is a covenantal transaction that is being made. And officially, the conflict between them comes to an end.
Mark, I just chime in real quickly. You just mentioned that Jacob is a changed man, right? He's a transformed man. And there's so much great application that we can press home. God's grace, his restoring grace, that he's in the business of changing us. He doesn't leave us as he found us, but he changes us, and his grace penetrates deep into the darkest places of our hearts, and he makes us new creatures. And as I'm looking at my Bible, following along as you're so wonderfully opening this up, and I just have two phrases underlined. And you may touch on this later or not, but so you mentioned, Jacob is a changed man. And what is it that is the foundation of that change? Well, it's the grace of God. If you look back in verse 5, he says, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." And then in verse 11, "Please accept my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me." It's just as if Jacob, he knows that he is but a recipient now of God's grace. It's the grace of God that has sunk deep into Jacob's heart. That is the basis, and that's what has changed him. It's God's grace in changing him from the the rebel thief to this patriarch, this wonderful servant of the Lord who knows that he is a trophy of grace. So just those two phrases stuck out to me as you were walking through these verses.
Yeah, great. What a change in him. He goes from being the deceiver to being humble, acknowledging where his blessings have come from, not through his conniving deception, but through the grace of God. Esau proposes that they travel on together. "Let's journey on our way, and I'll go ahead of you." It's 12, and Esau figures, if Jacob's coming down to visit, down to Seir to visit, why not travel together? But you might remember where God told Jacob to go to Canaan. So what's he going to do? He has to disengage from Esau, obey God, but he has to do it tactfully. And so Jacob puts a little polish on his refusal, and he doesn't just say no. He creates some excuses, some reasons he can't do it, and they're plausible. I can remember when my children were babies, they were oh so convenient at times for my wife and I to get out of obligations we didn't necessarily want to attend. The baby needs to get to bed, or the baby's crying, or whatever the case may be, and we're just basically taking a page out of Jacob's playbook, because that's basically what he does. "My Lord knows the children are frail. The nursing flocks and herds are a care to me. If they drive hard for one day, the flocks will all die." So, and these are plausible reasons. My livestock, my children, I can't really keep pace with you. I don't want to hold you up, kind of thing. And we know from the context of the story, as well as what happens later, that Jacob has no intention of following Saul. And probably what he ought to say is, "God's commanded me to go to Canaan, so hasta la vista, dear brother." But he's afraid of what might happen, so he concocts this little bit of deception. Or is it deception? Moses, narrates the story, but there's no condemnation of Jacob for doing this. The Bible doesn't tell us if it's a culpable untruth that he's telling. It's ambiguous. It's kind of incidental to the story. I don't think it exhibits a lack of faith on Jacob's part. I think it's a plausible reason, and it doesn't introduce any additional conflict. Esau offers to leave some of his men with Jacob, but Jacob is very staunch in his refusal of that. He's polite, but he's practically begging Esau, "Look, can we just go our separate way? We've shaken hands, we're reconciled. I've got to go my way, and you've got to go yours." Esau shows a surprising graciousness. He just parts ways peaceably with Jacob, and he returns now to Seir. Esau fades from view now. It seems that the only time Esau and Jacob get together again is at the death of Isaac. And in a couple chapters from now, we'll see that Esau moves even further away and his story is included. Esau's off the scene now. We'll, of course, read more about his descendants, but that's the end of Esau. So Jacob continues on his journey, and it goes to Succoth. He builds himself a house there. He makes booths for his livestock. That's what Succoth means, basically little sheds. You can stick the cattle, the sheep. Succoth was just east of the Jordan River, so just north of the Jabbok. So he crosses back over the Jabbok. It's a nice little spot where two rivers come together, great for your herds and all that. Nice little valley there. Perfect place to stop, settle in for a bit, replenish your supplies, water your flocks and all that. So we don't know how long he stays there, but very soon he's on the move. Verse 18 tells us he comes to Shechem and Canaan, and now that's on the west side of the Jordan River. So that's about halfway between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. So just about parallel with the Jabbok River east. So two large mountains, Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal, on either side of Shechem. Shechem occupies kind of a trail between the mountain. And he's back. He's back where God had commanded him to go. By the way, I should add here, if you're teaching, preaching this passage, again, it can be very helpful as part of the storytelling, if you will, to have a map, maybe put a map in the bulletin or something like that, a picture that just shows where he's moving, what these movements are, or you can try your best verbally to describe them to people. But it's always helpful for people to know, you know, instead of just these places nobody's been to, or most nobody's been to give them a map and show them where these movements are taking place, particularly because he's journeying to Canaan, and that's significant. So again, he comes back a changed man. Verse 18 tells us he came safely to Shechem. And that word can have a lot of, coming safely here, can a lot of connotations to it. It can simply mean that he arrived safely, or it can also be an antonym. The opposite of he arrived deceitfully is he arrived not deceitfully, safely. And quite possibly, the picture is the deceiver Jacob goes away, and 20 years later, he returns without deceiver, without deception. He leaves a guilty man, and he returns an innocent man. Whereas Robert put it a few moments ago, this man formerly full of guile now returns full of grace of God. So he makes this his home. He purchased the property. He settles there. Back in chapter 28, when God had met with Jacob, Jacob promised that if God would be with him and would keep him and would provide for him, that he would return to his father's house. But instead, he settles in this Canaanite city. He's attracted to this Canaanite urban, not really urban, I guess, but civilization center. Something reminiscent of Lot, perhaps, here, but we'll see in the chapter ahead that it does have some consequences to it. But his intentions seem to be noble. And in this four-part drama, begins with the angels of God ministering to Jacob. And in the middle, God wrestling with Jacob. Now it ends with God, Jacob. And this is where I think we get to the high point of the text. You could say that I've been burying the lead, if you will, but I think you find it at the very end of the chapter. There he erected an altar, and he called it El Elohe Israel, which means God, the God of Israel. He builds an altar. And throughout Genesis, we've seen the significance of these altars before, so I won't go through all of that again, but there's a couple interesting things about this altar. First, when Abram obeyed God's command, the first place he comes in Canaan is Shechem, where he builds an altar. Again, connecting this to the larger narrative, Jacob is retracing his footsteps. And then when we look at the story of Abraham, we observe that everywhere he went, he built altars, and they had several functions. They weren't just places of communion with God, but they were also symbols of claiming a place for their own, kind of like planting a flag in art or something. This altar constructed by Jacob, like it was with Abraham, is a public declaration of his faith in God. So he's in the midst of a pagan people. It's clear that though he's among them, he's not of them, and that's why he gives the altar, the name of God. And the 20-year journey's end now has come. He's back in the land of promise, communing with God as his grandfather Abraham had been many years ago. And the centerpiece of Act 4 of this whole drama of Jacob approaching Canaan, anticipating meeting Esau, the centerpiece is found in the building of this altar. Jacob is reconciled to Esau, but above all, he's reconciled to God. His reconciliation with Esau is a precursor to that. It's a beautiful picture, I think, of reconciliation, forgiveness, conflict come to its picture of how God works, even in the hearts of unbelievers like Esau. And yet part of that picture is the fact that while Jacob humbly makes peace with Esau and he lives at peace with him, at the same time he refuses to travel with him, but he continues on the journey God sent him. And I think that Esau is another picture of our common interaction with unbelievers. Jacob doesn't harbor a grudge against Esau or vice versa. Jacob approaches him peaceably. He makes reparation for his wrongdoing. Esau does him no harm. He even extends forgiveness to him, but Esau's not a man of faith. You know, they were able to reconcile, but notice the interaction here. The Bible doesn't confuse being able to dwell at peace and extending and receiving forgiveness with your fellow man. The Bible doesn't confuse that with being in possession of saving faith. And we have a picture of how Jacob interacts with the unbelieving world around him as Jacob, as Abraham, is a pilgrim. And we sometimes have the tendency to think that, you know, the good people are Christians, right? Christians are good moral people, so we enter into partnership with them, or worse, we enter into relationships with them because, I mean, good people, you know, somebody who's good, well, they must be a believer. But just because somebody's moral doesn't mean he's a believer, that he worships the one true God. Just because a person is what we might call a good man doesn't mean that he is not hostile to the things of God. And we can't forget what Paul tells us in Romans 8, the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God. It doesn't submit to God's law, and it can't. It's not just the unbeliever will not submit. He can't submit all. So like Jacob, we need to continue on our way. We need to live at peace with everyone as much as is possible, but not be yoked together with unbelievers, not travel with them. This is what Paul addresses in 2 Corinthians 6, where Paul says, "Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers, for what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness? What fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? What portion does a believer share with an unbeliever?" And we usually read this, I don't know if we usually do, but make direct application to marriage, right? Because that is a good application. Don't marry outside the faith. At other times, we can read this passage and say, well, it applies to business partnerships, you know, and there perhaps can be an application there. But the next verse gives us a clue as to the heart of our reason for not traveling with the unbeliever. And it's verse 16. What agreement has the temple of with idols? For we are the temple of the living God, as God has said. Goes on to alter. He can't travel with Esau. In the context of Paul's day, when he writes about in 1 Corinthians 6, or 2 Corinthians 6, rather, Paul's talking about worship. There were pagans who wanted believers to participate in the pagan temples, participating in the feasts of the false gods, and the new covenant believer, the unbeliever, they can't gather around the same altar. And that brings us back to the central theme here in this chapter, the building of the altar. What makes us, what makes Jacob separate from Esau? What makes Jacob go his own way, not partner with Esau? What makes us separate from the unbeliever? It's the worship of God. It's our worship that makes us different. And that's why our worship is sacred. It's the center of what we do as a body, found in our worship. The unbeliever is invited to sit and observe and watch the church as it were at work, as you know, we fulfill God's covenant promises, or as God fulfills his covenant promises to dwell with us. But we don't tailor or change our worship, our walk, to appeal to the unbeliever, because the heart of the covenant promise is what Paul goes on to say, I will make my dwelling among them, that's what the picture of the altar signifies, and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And that's what the altar is all about, God with us. All of it always pointing to God with us. All of it always pointing to the work of Jesus Christ, because the Great Commission, I am with always, even to the thief on the cross. Actually, not really a thief on the cross, it's the convert on the cross. Today, you will be with me in paradise. So that's the picture of the believer's separation from the world in terms of our worship, because we dwell with God as he dwells with us. All of our work, our journey in this wilderness, is pressing toward the promises of God, the anticipation of crossing the river into the land of promise, all of them done in and through Jesus Christ, Emmanuel, God with us. So back to Paul in 2 Corinthians 6, he's not talking about marriage when he says, don't be unequal. We can apply it to that. But he's talking about the fact that believers ought not to be engaged in this earthly journey, similar to Jacob. We should not be engaged in this earthly journey, in any activity, any work, in which we can't fully engage in conformity to the law of Christ. Oil and water don't mix. Light and darkness, righteousness has no partnership with lawlessness. God has no companionship with Satan. And part of Jacob's separation from Esau is a walk in holiness, claiming the promises of the altar. God will dwell with you. And this is how we must walk, with Christ, with God, with us, not engaging ourselves then in works of darkness. Romans 13, Ephesians 5, at one time you were darkened of the world. And as children of light, we belong to the day. We belong to the day of the Lord. And like Jacob, we ought to be separate from the ungodliness and walk in faithfulness as we journey to the land of promise. We do so through Christ, God with us. Jacob does so as he sets up the altar, a picture of God dwelling with him. So Jacob is reconciled to Esau, but he doesn't journey with Esau. He sets his dwelling place with God.
Mark, I'm so appreciative of how you, just all the beautiful applications that you teased out, and how you drew our attention to the very last verse and the building of the altar, how everything was driving towards that, towards worship, right? Towards worship of the one true God. And as you were mentioning that, it struck me how Jacob is very Abraham-like in how he's presented, mm-hmm. because the altar is mentioned in verse 20, and then in verse just above it, you have the reference to the tent, you know, on which he had pitched his tent. And so often Abraham is described, I know in our conversations here, I know our brother Lane Tipton has kind of summarized Abraham as a man of tent and altar, right? Mm. That pilgrim worshiper. And so here is Jacob. After the Lord has transformed him, Jacob is a man of tent and altar likewise. Altar, verse 20, and tent, verse 19. And you ask, you know, where did he pitch his tent? Well, he pitched his tent on a piece of land that he bought. And of course, you think of Abraham, and actually a fairly lengthy description of Abraham's negotiation to buying that piece of property so that he could bury his wife, Sarah. So you have the focus on purchasing, you know, owning the land, the place where God dwells with his people, tent and altar. It's just, there's this, I think, just beautiful connections with Jacob's grandfather, right, with Abraham. And now we see those same truths here with Jacob. And then so many wonderful applications that you brought out is how we are called to live with and in an unbelieving world, you know, to be in the world, but not of the world. And Jacob is such a great picture here, as you rightly highlighted. So I appreciate how you unpack that.
Yeah, that's great, Rob. That's another wonderful connection, the tent, the altar, and again, connecting this story with that larger narrative, that larger piece, and recognizing that as believers, we, you know, we're not in the ancient land of Israel geographically, but we're in the same redemptive picture. We are pilgrims. We are journeying mm-hmm. to the land that God's given us. We dwell among inhabitants of a foreign land, and yet our identity is found in God with us, and the altar symbolize that. So yeah, very good. Thank you, Rob. Well, next we'll come to chapter 34 as we continue on in our journey through the book of Genesis. But appreciate, Robert, your interaction with us today. Robert is the pastor of Redeemer Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Dayton, Ohio. Robert, where can our listeners find out more about you?
They can search DaytonOPC.org, and that should bring up our website. And if folks are in the area, Southwest Ohio, the Dayton area, we would love to have folks come and worship with us.
And my name is Mark Winder, pastor of Wolf River Presbyterian Church in Collierville, Tennessee. I encourage you to go on the website of the Reformed Forum and think about how you might be able to support the work of the Reformed Forum, which is a 501c3 organization, how you might be able to contribute to that work. Also, you can go down to the Reformed Forum store and shop as well, both books, even apparel and collectibles. You can get yourself a Voss Group t-shirt, a Reformed Forum t-shirt, or even, at the time that I'm looking at this, Reformed Forum 5-pack, including a mug, glass, hat, looks like a sweatshirt, and a t-shirt. That's another way that you can support the work of the Reformed Forum. And thank you for listening.